government is not our master, it is our servant. Its only power, that which we the people allow it to have.
Liberty Watch is an independent program on KVOI dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master, and operating in the public interest for which the media in this country was designed by exploring controversy. This helps us to resolve our differences peaceably, refining controversy into clarity through investigation, research, interview of experts, and public feedback. Liberty Watch is based in objective reason and is biased towards individual liberty, and so is not the view of the station or anyone but the host, guests, and callers. Liberty Watch operates outside the realm of political correctness, taking no notice at all of race, creed, religion, ethnicity, political affiliation, or orientation, focusing on content of character in eternal vigilance to the free flow of information about government, technology, current events, and our steadfast Constitution. The program is paid, produced, hosted, and operated by Charles Heller, and any mistakes are solely his responsibility. Responsibility, how the topic keeps recurring. We have the joy and pleasure and honor of having with us Philip Williams. He's returned. He is the head in Tucson of BBSI, which does a lot of compliance work and it helps people kind of comply with OSHA, and also does workman's comp insurance as well, right? Oops, forgot to turn your mic on. So go ahead.
Now, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, among other things, we help you with all the overhead that comes with having employees.
Yeah, and if you don't do business with them, you're losing out. All right, on to the topic at hand, which is Federalist number 39, which is about federalism. What is federalism?
That is a very good question, because I would like to actually, if I was going to rename the sort of casual title of this, because I think people call it an exposition on federalism, but I would call it an exposition for the argument of states' rights and individual rights.
It's too clunky.
Yeah, it is too clunky, but that's actually what this paper is about. This paper talks about how we didn't want a really strong central government, that we had to maintain the voice of the people and the voice of the states. And that's really where this paper talks about. But they did give sort of, I think it's about five key points with regard to how do you define federalism and as well a republic, right? Because we're not a popular democracy, right?
No.
We were intentionally designed to not be a popular democracy.
In fact, we were designed to be a system that fought against democracy, that enshrined protections against democracy.
Yeah, because on the Italian peninsula, which is, you know, where Rome fell, the founders studied the various forms of government that popped up, and I think on average, it was about a popular democracy lasted about 75 years when they looked at all the forms of government.
Three generations.
Yeah, that was it. That was it. Well, three generations. Have you seen Joe Rogan talk about
it? I don't watch Joe Rogan. The only Joe Rogan I see are like 15-second to 2-minute YouTube clips on YouTube Shorts.
So he had a joke that popped up the other day. He says, yeah, America was born in 1776. The average person lives to be 100. So that's three people ago.
Average person lives to be a lot less than 100.
The 5 points, you know, back to your question, what is federalism? And the number one, they actually chose to talk about what is a republic. That was the question that they addressed in the paper. And they said the number one element is that the power of the government is derived directly from the voice of the people. And then number two, the people administering the government are appointed, or in this case, voted in by the people, the body public, and hold that office for a specified time.
Mm-hmm.
Members of the judiciary, there's another trait, members of the judiciary hold their terms so long as they exhibit good behavior. So, you know, life, and you can be impeached for bad behavior. The chief magistrate, a.k.a. the president, is impeachable while in office. And that was a key point for them, right? Because kings are not impeachable. Good luck impeaching somebody like Xi Jinping or Putin, right? That ain't going to happen, right? You're not going to impeach King Charles.
Just
you can't get rid of him.
Just ask Anatoly Navalny what happens when you try to impeach a Putin.
Right. I heard it doesn't go well.
Yeah, it's a non-positive experience.
And then the definition of federal, having or relating to a system of government in which several states form a unity but remain independent in internal affairs. And so that's one of the things that this paper, as I read it, we have forgotten that we are not a democracy. We are a collection. We are a confederation mm-hmm. of states who have all agreed to work together in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
The states are independent. So that actually kind of points out why the left so much dislikes Trump. Because at the end of the day, he's actually a states' rights guy.
Mm-hmm.
He is. When you look at what he did with tax policy in his first term, when you look at the tax credits that states were giving, as an example, you know that when you pay a certain amount of taxes in Arizona,
right, it's deductible from your federal income.
It was deductible. Before Trump, it was deductible.
Right.
And then he said, no, we're going to cap that number.
Right.
And when he capped that number, you had states like California and New York squealing.
Right.
Because now their people are yelling at them because they're overpaying in taxes.
Right, and because the federal government, they were shifting the burden onto the federal government but doing
right.
that. And Trump says, no, we're not going to pay for California's folly.
Which thereby, it's not
it's
we're,
federalism.
It's we're not going to make North Dakota residents
pay for California.
Pay a federal tax that we then funnel directly to a state that decides to have a really, really high local tax. That's not North Dakota's problem. That's not Kansas's problem. That's a California problem. That's a New York problem. That's an Arizona problem. All that fun stuff. So we've gotten away from this idea that we are a collection of states that have agreed to operate together. And really the only purpose of the federal government is to provide things that make the states want to work together.
Right, and things that states couldn't do independently, like you couldn't have an entire California Air Force and a Nevada Air Force and a Arizona Air Force. You can have a National Guard, but you can't have a whole Air Force that's competent.
Right, and the other idea is competent Air Force, a singular recognized currency, right?
Right. Where
you're not allowed to have a California dollar and right. a Missouri dollar. They can't be different valuations. So you have a common currency, common defense.
Right.
You have laws that allow you to walk from one state to another, which is going to be really, really interesting in the coming days. I can't recall, on Friday, did the Supreme Court agree to hear the universal constitutional carry?
No. That's not what they're talking about.
There's a universal
constitution. That's a bill. It's not.
No,
I don't
no,
think it's
no. There's
the Supreme Court case.
No, there's also a Supreme Court case, and it had been postponed several times, and then it was on the docket as to whether or not it was going to. I think it was going to conference. The whole idea is part of the reason that the federal government exists is to provide a set of laws that right. everybody agrees.
And an administration system of it.
Right. Yeah. A citizen enjoys free speech no matter what state they're in. If they buy a house in Florida, they know that a soldier can't be forced to or be allowed to live there. If they buy a different house in Idaho, they know that a soldier's not going to be allowed to live there. So there were common rights that were agreed to. So we have forgotten this concept of states' rights, and I end up going down the rabbit hole on the 17th. I think you were talking about going down the rabbit hole on the 14th.
Right, but we'll do that at the end,
yeah,
not in the beginning. And if you want to run over and if you have time, we can. I don't have a guest booked in the last hour.
Well,
based
we'll
on what happened
goes.
The first time you were on.
Right.
That was a total surprise and revelation to me. We're up on our first break. Let's just go ahead and start the break. We have officially begun the first question after the first segment of the program. So hang on. Be right back with Philip Williams and discussing Federalist number 39. Swap Shop trains are coming. Rolling down that free market track. Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
Never give up on the power of the Swap Shop.
Who knows? And I mean, somebody could have had a whole bunch of old pagers laying around, and they called the Swap Shop and said, can we buy them? We got an order for some pagers. We just need to work on them a little bit first.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Mark Levin. Liberty Watch on KVOI is dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master. Sounds like Charles has been reading my books. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore.
Indeed, indeed. Music that Philip used to sing to his daughter for lullabies.
Yep, that's the song that I learned for my oldest daughter.
There you go. Sometimes the music has to match the topic, but sometimes it has to match the mood to do good radio.
Yeah, I love that song, and it reminds me of singing her to sleep at night.
Yeah, cool. Well, we have a topic on the table about the Federalist number 39, and talking about the federal system instead of a national system is what I was going to go out on.
So that's actually the core of this paper. And so you have to understand, what is the difference between national and federal? So what is national? Well, that actually takes us to selection of the U.S. Congress. So the House of Representatives is picked solely by popular vote. So that's the national model. The Senate was to be appointed by the states. So we popularly elect a governor in each state, and then the governor appointed a senator. That is a federal concept, where the right of the states is an appointment by the governor, and then each state was represented co-equally. And where we have strayed from that intent is that now senators are essentially elected popularly, like the House of Representatives, rather than that one-step removal of having the senator be appointed by the governor of the state. So the Senate was the place where the will of the state was to be represented on average or on whole, and the House was the place where that's why they call it the People's House. The House was to represent the direct will of the people. And then in order to get a bill passed and put on the president's desk, you had to have both the House and the Senate.
That was part of the separation of powers.
No, separation of powers is legislative, judicial,
right,
and executive.
True, but it also didn't make the power flow towards the center. That was what you did. That established a sort of centrifugal balance in power, the interests of the people versus the interests of the states. And it kept the power flowing away from Washington.
Right. And the idea was that the central government is not to be that strong. It wasn't supposed to have control over the daily lives of people. That the only purpose of the federal government was to unite the commonalities of the states. Right. So here's a really good example that they talked about in the paper. They alluded to, and I sort of enumerated this a little bit differently, but if we had a strong national government, a centrist government, essentially like a Russian style, where municipalities report directly to a federal, and there's no such thing really as a state.
Soviets.
Yeah, districts, if you will, which is not the same as an independent state. So if we had a strong national government, then seven colonies could have voted in favor of the Constitution, thus forcing the other six to come along. That's not what happened. Each colony had to ratify the Constitution on its own, and every subsequent state, in order to move from colony to state or territory to state, actually had to ratify the U.S. Constitution. You were made to vote in favor of the U.S. Constitution if you wanted to become a state.
They had to agree to be bound by it.
Right. And you couldn't have seven colonies force the other six. In fact, two colonies didn't come along for about a year after the first 11 ratified it.
Maine?
Right? Yep. And I wanted to say Georgia, but I don't think that's right.
No, not Vermont. I don't remember either.
No, maybe it was Maryland?
Hmm.
I don't know. I'd have to look. But the point is, the idea of a national government is where a simple majority manages things, and that's not how we're done. They actually point out that the election of the U.S. president is a federal process. And this is why I get so frustrated when somebody says to me they want to do away with the Electoral College. Because the Electoral College, the election of the president, is a blend of two concepts. It's a blend of the popular will of the people and a blend at the state level, at the statehood level, wanted. And so the way they describe it is each state chooses a president, and the Electoral College concept or innovation gives weight to the state based on their population. So it's both a federal and a national concept, right? Mm-hmm. And the whole idea there is we are represented in picking a president on the House side, if you will. You know, our popular vote, we have a certain number of votes that are picked. And then you've got two more votes for your senator, mm-hmm. for each of your
right.
two senators.
That's how many electors there are.
Yes, exactly. Right. That's the way it works out. So if electing the president is a federal process, how many states did Trump win in 2016?
How many states did he win in 2016?
Well, let me back up for a
28?
Second. Let me ask you another trick question.
Yeah.
We have this electoral college system for choosing a president. It's a federal process.
Right.
What was the goal of the electoral college?
270. Well, to get a majority of the votes in the election. Oh, what was the goal of
it?
To make sure that the large population centers did not dominate the rest of the
You're rural, close. You're going
farmers,
down the right track.
To make sure they didn't dominate the farmers.
They wanted the president, that person, that individual, to represent the largest, most diverse group of people.
Okay.
Okay. So you missed the number in 16. You said 28. What was his state count in 20? I'll give you the numbers when we're done.
Well, I know the Electoral College vote.
I don't know the number of states. Remember, we're thinking about states' rights.
I don't know the number of states. I never really paid attention to that.
Here's the numbers.
Most of them, I would think.
Here's the numbers. By state, in 2016, he won 30 states.
Oh, that was close. 20.
That's pretty representative of a pretty diverse backing. And I believe he was 95.5% of the counties in 2016.
Wow.
Yeah. In 2020, he won 25 states. And the margin of vote, we won't go down the rabbit hole of whether or not there was ballot harvesting, but the margin of vote on Biden's side was actually found in the large cities.
Mm-hmm.
In 24, how many states did he win?
34?
31.
31, okay.
31. So when you think about the concept of electing the president being a federal thing, think about, you know, the idea that states have a voice in picking the president.
Mm-hmm.
When you have when you're winning the presidency by 31 states, I mean, heck, Reagan won it 49 states, right?
Right, the second time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, is it first time or second?
Second time.
Was
all
49.
But Minnesota.
All but, yeah, right.
Heck of a thumping.
Yeah.
So when you have that resounding, you know, the whole idea of electing a president is it is a federal process. It's not intended to be a popular process. It's not a national process. Federal. So federal means a blend of the voice of the citizen as well as the collective voice of the citizens within a state.
Right, the people of a state.
So those are the two concepts that you have to unite to understand what federalism is. It's a combination of your voice as an individual and then the voice of your collective state.
I'll give you a working example of federalism. Federal law, 1996, there's the Gun-Free Safe School Zones Act of 1996, says it's illegal to be within 1,000 feet of a school zone anywhere in the United States if the gun has traveled in interstate commerce and it's loaded and it's in your vehicle. It's illegal. Unless, and there's seven exemptions to it, exemption number seven is unless you have a concealed weapons permit from your state. And so the federal law makes it illegal to be on the school grounds with a gun unless the state has granted you a permit to do it. Even though state law makes it illegal to be on the grounds of the school with a loaded gun, the state permit makes it federally legal. That's an example of federalism, where the federal government acknowledges the authority of the state.
Isn't it interesting that we're having to go back through and relitigate and repass all of thing, a bunch of concepts that are all already addressed in one sentence,
well,
the right of the
be,
people
you know,
to keep and bear arms shall not
be
infringed.
Right,
it's already litigated, and here we are doing it all over again.
By the same token, it is not an infringement of rights if a person abuses their rights and does something egregious with them. It is not an abridgment of said rights to have those rights abrogated by a court of competent jurisdiction.
Right.
Or severed.
You have a right to your rights.
Right.
You don't have a right to beat me up with your rights.
To abuse someone else's rights with using yours. And if you do, your rights can be limited or terminated.
Right.
So that's not a violation of... Now, some people, the purists, I know one in particular, will be screaming at his speakers right now, calling me a fascist, because I said that, no, if your rights aren't, then your rights aren't absolute. Well, no, rights aren't absolute. Your rights end at the edge of the other person's rights.
Yes.
Your right to swing your arms does not end at your neighbor's nose. Your rights to swing your arms ends at the arc of your neighbor's right to swing his arms. That's what some people don't understand.
Right. It's a Venn diagram.
Right.
There's a place where your rights interfere with my rights. Think of it like that.
Right.
You know, we got Charles' rights, we got Phil's rights. There's a spot in there where those two circles, when they overlap each other, that's the zone where that we have a problem.
Yep. All right. To move on, did you have another point, or did I?
At the moment, I'm kind of curious about your 14th question.
Well, that's at the end, but we might as well do it now. We can skip ahead. We don't have to go Syria.
Because you know I'm anti-17th, right?
Oh, I'm dedicated. If there was one thing I could change in the United States, it would be the abolishment of the 17th Amendment.
Oh, we're on the same page. We should start a new show.
Well, ironically that you say that, we do have an opportunity. We do have an avail here at 8 a.m. on Saturdays. If you'd like to be that show, we can arrange it.
Uh-oh.
So, yeah,
repeal the 17th.
Yeah, repeal the 17th. God, we need a sexier name like 17th Nuns. Something. I don't know. Anyway, in what respect did the 14th Amendment's incorporation of the rights of the individual, in other words, the federal government's interference is the wrong word, entrance into the debate to keep the states from depriving the citizens of their right to due process and equal protection under the laws, at what point did the 14th Amendment's allowing or empowering the federal government to stop the state from abrogating individual rights fly in the face of federalism? Do you need me to restate it?
Yeah, because when I think of the 14th is one of the amendments that came out of the Civil War, right?
Adopted in 1868.
Yep. The purpose of the 14th was to state that all men were created equal without actually bringing up the concept of race.
Right.
And you have to remember that we were coming from a twisted place in time where a man, because of the color of his skin, was worth 3/5.
And, well, he was owned by another man.
Right. But he gave somehow extra weighting without you being allowed to hear his voice.
For purposes of representation in Congress, right?
Right, right. And so it was a really twisted place. And so the idea behind the 14th was to say that, no, the man has his own voice.
Well, the idea of the 14th was that originally the Bill of Rights was incorporated only on the federal government, not on the states.
Right.
And that what it did was it empowered the federal government, in fact, directed the federal government to protect the rights of the individual citizen against state infringement. And that had never been true before the 14th Amendment. And it wasn't true universally and all at once. The Supreme Court has practiced what they call selective incorporation. The Second Amendment was not incorporated against the states until 2008 in District of Columbia versus Heller. They had never done that until then. But one thing I am going to do is incorporate the next break on both of us. So stand by.
Thank you for listening to Liberty Watch.
Swap shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
I wanted to give a big shout out to Arizona Tree. I noticed a saguaro, and it was going to fall right on my well. The biggest arm blew off, and it lost its balance.
Well, so we do support the right of cactus to keep and bear arms.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Dennis Prager. Liberty Watch is dedicated to the notion that government remain servant, not master. Goes very well with my concept of E Pluribus Unum, liberty, and in God we trust. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
I'm walking behind you on your wedding day. And I'll hear you promise to love and obey. Though you may forget me, you're still on my mind. Look over your shoulder, I'm walking behind.
And that was the other one, wasn't it? Was that the right one?
No, but you're going to make me cry.
Okay. I thought that was the one that you said. I was standing there.
On the street where you live.
On the street where you live. That'll be in the next break if I can find it. Ingrid, you have a comment or question. Go ahead.
The founders did not want poor people involved in government. And that sounds very aristocratic, I guess. And if they didn't want poor people voting, and that sounds very aristocratic and snooty, and it deprived people of a voice in government. And that continued on. It continues to this day. For instance, you said something about the largest, most diverse group of people. Well, you know, when I vote for president, I want my vote to count as much as somebody's in Pennsylvania or Utah. This person is the president of every individual. And we have certain groups of people have manipulated things so that they have an advantage, an unfair advantage, over other groups of people.
Yeah, that's human nature, though, Ingrid. That's not just
the United States. But human nature, I mean, human nature is to lie, steal. Some people are very, you know, negative. We have a right, I have a right to a vote for my president of this country that should be equal to everybody else's. I'm speaking for myself. I know a lot of people don't agree with me.
I think a lot of people work. I think more do, number one. And number two, you don't actually vote for the president. You vote for the electors that elect the president. And number three
that's
is...
the problem.
No, that's the solution. That's the solution, Ingrid.
To what problem?
Thank you for asking. That is a very reasonable question. The problem of the country being dominated by the large population centers, it would diminish your vote to get rid of the Electoral College, and here is why. What would happen is all the power would concentrate in New York, Los Angeles.
The 11 cities,
starting with New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Houston, Texas, Dallas, Texas, and what other ones? Atlanta, Georgia, and
Philadelphia.
And Philly,
Baltimore.
Right.
What's the point of that? Well, the individual is being represented by a president, and if I don't want a war over Greenland or whatever, my vote should count as much as anybody else's.
It won't if you get rid of the Electoral College. The country will be dominated by 11 cities. The people outside
they are human beings. They are citizens of the United States.
They are.
It doesn't make
so
any
are the people in the small towns of 15,000.
Right.
It doesn't make any difference where you come from.
It makes a huge...
Why?
Because the population is not all in those larger cities. And if you don't have the electoral... This is a great discussion. I love that you're bringing this up, Ingrid. Because if you don't have the Electoral College, what will happen is all the power will be concentrated on those 11 cities. And candidates will be forced to campaign in mostly in those 11 cities and ignore the rest of the population. And it will diminish...
Candidates for what?
What?
We're not candidates for what? We're not voting
candidate
for
president
or governor or
no, 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 for president. Candidates for president. That's the discussion on the table. Candidates for president, if you get rid of the Electoral College, will be forced to do most of their campaigning in the 11 places where there's the most votes, because the votes of the other places won't matter. It will diminish.
Campaigning for president?
What?
Campaigning for president?
True.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
Go look at a map.
That's exactly what they should be doing. They should be heard by everybody.
Ingrid, right, but they won't.
Ingrid,
go ahead.
Ingrid, as proof of this, go look at a map of the counties that were won by Hillary Clinton. She was a few million votes shy of President Trump in the 2016 election. She only won in 4.5% of the counties in the United States. That's a perfect explanation of why the Electoral College is necessary, because we've got to get the largest cross-section, the most diverse group of people represented by the president. That's the point of the Electoral College.
Everybody represented.
Right, exactly.
But everybody won't be represented.
Ingrid, if you don't have the Electoral College, the votes of the people in the less densely populated states will become irrelevant, because you won't need their vote to win.
You would never see a presidential candidate in North or South Dakota. Never. Or Idaho or Montana or Wyoming. They wouldn't have to go there. They wouldn't have to talk to those people.
And there wouldn't be any point in the people in Idaho and Montana voting for president, because no matter who they voted for, if it was different than the people in the larger cities voted for, they would never be elected.
You wouldn't see anybody go to Delaware. Who cares about Delaware? Delaware wouldn't matter. It's so tiny. Who cares?
Why wouldn't it matter?
Because their vote wouldn't make a difference. I only have to win the votes of the 11 cities. That's it.
Because
Why?
because of the concentration of population there, Ingrid, if the people in New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Dallas, Atlanta, Philly, Baltimore, those are all dense population centers. And if those people all voted for one candidate, it doesn't matter what the rest of the country votes for, that candidate of the population centers would win, thereby disenfranchising everybody else in the country.
So the purpose of the Electoral College makes the states co-equal.
What, Ingrid, go ahead.
The ballots say what they say. I want to have Donald Duck for president. And if everybody votes for Donald, if more people vote for Donald Duck than Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck becomes president. And it doesn't make any difference where these people live.
It makes.
Okay, no, so let me ask you this, Ingrid. Hang on. So if that's the case,
do you agree with that statement?
I completely disagree with the concept of a popularly elected president.
No. Just the statement. If Donald Duck wins that election, shouldn't Donald Duck be president?
No, I completely disagree.
More people voted for him than Mickey Mouse.
I completely disagree with the concept of a popularly elected president because the president serves all of the states. He doesn't serve some of
the
states.
The individual citizen. The individual citizen. He's representing you and me and your host.
So, Ingrid, let me ask you this. Explain to me how the Electoral College works. Explain it.
You actually are voting for a group of people.
No, explain to me the construction. Explain to me the construction and how the weighting of the Electoral College works.
By the number of ballots. No.
So
it's divided two ways. The Electoral College is divided two ways. First off, every single state, regardless of its political viewpoint, how many people live there, every single state gets two votes. Okay. In the Electoral College, period. End of discussion. And then all of the remaining votes that are in the Electoral College are based on population. So the vast majority of the Electoral College is actually based on what happens on the popular vote within a state. So if California, as an example, chooses that they would like to have Kamala Harris be their president, on the popular side, they're going to get all of those votes go to Kamala. And then also their two votes on the senatorial side go. But that your rights as an individual citizen don't end there when it comes to choosing the laws of your country. And when you talk about popular choices that happen within our central, our federal government, if you're in California, you have an outsized weight on the laws that are constructed in our country. Why? Because I believe, what is it? You have 52 representatives in the House of Representatives, more than many other states combined, to choose how your state affects national law. So you're focusing on the...
What do you
just
mean your state affects national law?
Okay, so this goes back to, how does a bill become a law? It has to be popularly voted for in the U.S. House of Representatives, right?
I didn't talk about bills.
I'm talking about your voice.
Ingrid, hang on a second. Philip. Ingrid, stop thinking and just listen. No, it's not interrupting. Stop getting ahead of it and just listen to the example and let it percolate, then respond to the percolation. Phil?
I want you to think about how your voice is heard in many different ways and places within our government. Your voice is not only heard by the president. Remember that the president really actually only has the authority to enact the laws that Congress created and approved. Right. So Congress approves a law, goes to the president's desk, they sign it. That's the law. He's the executive branch. He's really the police officer. He doesn't make laws. The president does not make law. Neither does the judiciary. Law comes out of the U.S. Congress. So how does Ingrid's voice get heard when it comes to creating law at the national level within our government? Your voice is weighted based on the number of representatives that your state has in the House of Representatives. And it's also weighted by what your senators hear from you. That's where you make law at the federal level. So you, let's say a resident of California. California, I think it's 52. I might be off by a vote. How much?
I think you're right.
I think it's
52. They may have lost one in the last census. They may have lost one.
And we have, 435 members in
Congress.
The House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm.
right? So California has 52 votes in the House of Representatives when it comes to making law at the national level and telling the president what he has to do. That's where your true voice is. It's in the House of Representatives, and then it's, again, indirectly reinforced through senators and the Electoral College vote. Everybody that's focusing on this get rid of the Electoral College thing hasn't thought about how a law is created and the roles of the different parts of government. If you don't like the laws in your government, then go pick your House of Representatives differently. Call your House of Representatives much more often. That's where the laws are made. The president is simply an enforcer. He's the police officer that shows up and has to arrest somebody. Why? Well, because in our state, the law says that when we get called to domestic disturbance, somebody's going to jail. I don't care who it is, but somebody's going, right? So the president doesn't make law. And that's actually been further reinforced by several of the Supreme Court decisions that have come down and said, no, the president doesn't get to do that.
Right. It exceeds his authority.
Electoral College
agencies. But excuse me for interrupting, but we're way over on a break. I want you to hold on, Ingrid and Bill. Bill wants to talk to you.
Love it.
And good. And this is exactly what radio is built to do. Back in a little bit.
This is Dennis Weaver, and you're listening to Liberty Watch. You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country. And Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom.
He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet, our God.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch. This is what this program was built to do, which is have an intelligent discussion with people chiming in on their opinions. Okay, Philip, you can now finish what you're saying to Ingrid and let Ingrid respond, and then Bill's going to toss in.
First, I'd just like to say that I appreciate that Ingrid stuck around.
I do, too.
Because it's important that we have this conversation.
It is.
Not just here on the show, but like nationally. I would love it if folks understood how they were represented. And we've gotten very tied up on this idea of power being concentrated in the presidency. And we live in a system that is designed that power is actually supposed to be dispersed, not concentrated in one person. And if a concept isn't good enough to become law for everyone, then it's not supposed to become law. It's supposed to die or go back to the drawing board, and you invite more people to the table to have the conversation and maybe revise it and try again. So that's where I think we've lost sight of the vision for having this idea that people are – the House of Representatives is called the lower house by nickname because it's supposed to be close to you, Ingrid. So if you're frustrated with laws or the way things are done, I would encourage you to pick up the phone and call your member from the House of Representatives, to call your senators. That's where you actually have – that's your closest voice. The president is supposed to be slightly removed. Okay, it's a federal selection.
Ingrid, go ahead.
Okay. At this point, I'm going to make your blood boil.
Go ahead.
As far as I'm concerned, we can get rid of the Senate. We have the House of Representatives. We are now divided up as states. We are no longer colonies. We are united, the United States of America. I would be just as happy to have no Senate, just the House of Representatives, and my vote for president going directly to some ballot box.
So you would prefer a Soviet style of government?
No, that's not Soviet. That's not a Soviet style of government. That is normal voting.
If you abolish the Senate, then you abolish the voice of a state as its own entity.
And then what you just said about being United States, we'd be united, but we wouldn't be states.
And there would no longer be state boundaries. So that would mean that laws passed.
Yes, there would. No, there would. The purpose of the boundaries at this time, at this point in time, only served to deliver the mail. It's a convenience.
That's
not true at all. All, Ingrid. Look at the difference in right to keep and bear arms laws in Arizona versus New York.
Exactly. That should be a national decision.
No, that's exactly what this country was designed to prohibit, to fight against. Okay,
yeah.
Stop for a minute. Bill, please throw in on this.
Folks need to remember a couple of simple principles. One is we are not a direct democracy. We are a constitutional republic. And one of the principal core issues surrounding the idea of a constitutional republic is the rights of the minority are protected from the quote-unquote will of the majority. And one of the things that it's not explicit in the idea of the Electoral College
for implicit.
The president.
It's implicit, not explicit. Right.
Is the idea that you do not want the president of the United States only worrying about those 11 or dozen or how many ever heavily concentrated population centers are to the exclusion of everywhere else.
Bingo,
and
you got
you
it.
When you go down this road of directly electing these representatives and then put things to the ballot for the citizens to vote on, you're basically saying constitutional republics that are supposed to be protecting the rights of the citizens, that gets flushed down the tubes because that's what happens when you go down that road.
Absolutely.
That's the inevitable end point.
That's right. Ingrid, he's absolutely right.
Ingrid, I would encourage you, if you're still online or still listening,
she is.
I would encourage you to read Federalist Paper number 10 because it goes to exactly the heart of what Bill's talking about, which is the root of faction. The construction of our government, our system of government, was designed so that 51% of the people could not crush the voice of 49% of the people.
And which is exactly what would happen. Actually, it would be a smaller percentage.
Yeah, it'd be like 50.1.
No, I'm saying it would be about 20% of the people would be crushing 80%.
So the entire idea is if you can't get 65, 66% of the people to say that an idea is good for everyone, small town, large town, one race versus another, one job versus another, one industry versus another, all of those things, if you can't get 2/3 of the people to say that an idea is good for everyone, then your idea isn't good enough. Please go back to the drawing board, pull in more people from the minority, get more of their opinion, and then come back and repropose. That is the purpose of our government. It's to get rid of faction and to get rid of a totalitarian central concept.
Okay, if hang we, on. Is this, excuse me, AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. I'm bypassing the open of America Armed and Free because the discussion is so fluid. Philip, please go ahead.
If we have a totalitarian central concept where 51% of the people can tell 49% of the people what to do, then what you have is 27-year-old Mike Tyson versus 26-year-old Mike Tyson. Somebody's going to win, but they're only going to have probably one functioning eye left over when it's done.
Ingrid, you can respond.
In the future, I would like to see you give a good example of the significance of what you just said.
Ooh, what a great challenge.
I would like to see a fantasy election on some issue in the country as an experiment.
Well, there just was. There just was. The ballot initiatives in Arizona, which won and lost. There's exactly that example that already exists, Ingrid. There are many people in the state of Arizona who are diametrically opposed to abortion. They just got voted into silence.
So pretend that was the nation.
Everybody that's against abortion would have absolutely no legal leg to stand on.
And they wouldn't have any place in the country where they were willing to live.
Right.
Because we would have effectively, what just happened in Arizona wasn't...
You're comparing apples and oranges.
No, we're comparing apples to apples.
The president represents the country.
Right, but he doesn't run it. The states are the individual so-called laboratories of democracy.
Well, he signs certain documents.
Right, he runs the federal system. He runs the federal system. He's the commander-in-chief, but only the Congress can declare war. Okay, hold on, Ingrid. Bill, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Let's bring this down to a more local level. Let's take the state of California and the state of Arizona. If we go down the road of what Ingrid is talking about, basically in the state of Arizona, Phoenix would dictate what happens to the rest of Arizona. In the state of California, you've got two power centers, you know, San Francisco and Los Angeles, telling the rest of the state of California what it can and can't do. If we go down this road where it's the majority will all the time, in the state of California, there would be no water anywhere except in population centers in California. We could argue, given the circumstances last week, the merits of that. But, you know, in Arizona, do we want to see Phoenix dictating to Flagstaff and Page and Tucson and Nogales and Yuma what they should and shouldn't do 100% of the time?
I think that's a beautiful point. And actually, Ingrid, you're asking for an example on a smaller level and using Charles' statement about how the states are individual laboratories. In California, the agricultural communities in the northern part of the state are choking to death on the state's minimum wage. They are rural, and the state has passed a minimum wage based on what happens in the cities, and it's killing the farmers and the small towns that are outside of those large municipalities in California. So much so that if you look, you'll see that there are the eastern parts of Oregon and Washington and the northern part of California. There's this movement to try to get them to get their own state going. They are dying financially at the hands of what has been elected in the population centers, the large population centers within California.
And that's exactly what would happen writ large in the United States if you got rid of the Electoral College.
Except it would happen in every aspect of our lives.
Right.
And, you know, so I'm one generation removed from the farms. My parents grew up in farmhouses, didn't have indoor plumbing until they were like 6, 7, 8 years old. I've been to a farm. A farmer doesn't operate in the same place, in the same world as somebody who is a bond trader in New York City. But that bond trader in New York City needs that farmer to make a reasonable living every year, year in and year out, so that that guy's willing to go out and make sure that bread and corn and green beans can get to his table on Thanksgiving Day.
Furthermore, he has to have stocks to buy and sell and trade of those things in order for him to make his living.
Right.
Right. So, guys, this is a wonderful discussion. I got to end it at this point. We got a caller who's been waiting about 10 minutes on hold. I'm going to let him go. So, Ingrid, beautiful, absolutely beautiful point. Got to let you go. And next air, John, you got the patience of a saint. Go ahead.
It's my turn. As a political science major and a government bureaucrat at one time, what I think Ingrid is fixated on is this idea of one man, one vote. And what she probably ought to think about is, if you would like to have a democracy and you would like to have it live, what makes democracies fail? Because there have been many democracies in the world that have failed. And they fail because of what you guys have already mentioned, which is people stratify and they go into groups or whatever, and they try to control the government, and they want the 51% to become a dictatorial 51%. And that leads to revolution. And it fails.
And it's a cycle.
And if you want a good example, look at the American Civil War. When you have two groups of people in the country divided over an issue like slavery, and they are divided regionally, you have the beginnings of a civil war, because the one side is saying, what do we need the national government for? What do we need the other states for? They just mess up what we're doing. And so the revolt is what you end up having. What you touched on earlier, Philip, was this idea of the Electoral College gives you an idea of widespread support that cuts across state boundaries and regions and different types of people and whatever, and you end up with some kind of a composite president that has to satisfy groups across the entire nation. And that is what makes democracy survive. And I think that's what Ingrid is having a hard time understanding. I think she's thinking in terms of some pure idea of we all just get together and vote for whatever we believe. And that degree of diversity tends to, like I said, make people go into small groups and eventually revolt.
Yeah, it's the tyranny of the majority, right?
That's right. And the other concept that we need to understand, you touched on it, is what they call the preponderant majority. And that's what you need to have when you pass bills and laws and policies that affect the whole people. You need widespread support. The idea of thinking of a democracy as perfect little individuals that sit around and cast their ballot is a failing thought. I know it's a sweet thought, but it is a failing thought.
Since you're a political science guy, I think the idea of pure democracy, if we were all saints, would be a beautiful thing. Just as would be pure communism, if we were all well-behaved, pure communism in its most ideal form would be a beautiful thing, because we would all put in equal effort and get equal outcome
results
out of it.
Right.
Unfortunately, we don't live in a world where we're all saints, and we don't live in a world where everyone is equally as motivated for both the good of themselves and the good of the people. And so that's why we require this system where, in some manner, part of what Ingrid's asking for does exist. In the House of Representatives, she is directly elected, one voice, one vote. But in the Senate, she's indirectly represented. And then through her president, or the president, because this president that's incoming might not be hers, and in form of vote anyway, you're indirectly represented. But that's exactly right. We have to prevent the tyranny of the majority. And again, I would ask Ingrid, go back and read Federalist Paper number 10, because it talks about faction and preventing faction. And what the current caller is talking about is how democracies fail. The founding fathers actually looked at multiple forms of democracy that popped up after the fall of Rome. The Italian peninsula was an amazing laboratory for it. Average lifespan of a democracy on the Italian continent was 75 years. They couldn't last. A grandfather, his granddaughter, wouldn't grow up in the same country that he thought he elected when he was a young man of 20.
Once they found out they could vote themselves largesse from treasury, the country was finished.
And we are dangerously close to that now.
We absolutely are. Here's another thing, and that is, excuse me, John, I want to say one more thing, and then please, I'm not going to cut you off. There is a percentage at which democracy becomes moral. There is a voting percentage at which it becomes moral for all of the people to decide what all the people, what the people decide is going to become the law for everyone. Do you know what that percentage is, John or Philip, in a democracy?
I really have no idea. I'm guessing somewhere around 75%, maybe.
No.
It'd have to be 100.
Correct.
Again, if it's pure, right?
Right, exactly. There is a percentage at which democracy becomes moral. 100%.
If we're in a small group of seven and everybody votes the same way, great, then everybody's happy. But if five of the people vote one way and two of the people vote the other, then there's going to be two unhappy people. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, the group can survive with two unhappy people. But if you have a group of seven and four vote one way and three vote the other, that three is big enough to cause a problem.
And remember the analogy of two foxes and a chicken voting where to go to lunch.
Yeah, exactly. Voting on the dinner.
Yeah, the chicken's going to lose. Yeah.
Well, in a republic, you have a well-armed chicken to deny enforcement of the vote.
I would like to shift the discussion, if I may.
Go ahead.
Please.
Two sort of trivial things for this discussion. When you're talking about the Electoral College, learn how to say electoral.
Electoral.
It's not electoral. That is wrong. You can look that up in about four or five dictionaries. That's the popular way to say it today. That came from people who couldn't say electoral. It's election. It's elected. It's elect. The stress goes on the lec syllable, not the tor syllable. And so there, now, I messed you up good. The other thing I'd like to say to Philip is you got to look up that three-fifths idea you presented earlier, because you think that somebody actually proposed that, you're nuts. Look, nobody in Congress or the Constitutional Convention ever proposed that blacks were three-fifths of a white. No one ever did.
Right. It was for purposes of representation.
You got it, Charles. It was a compromise. Right. And here's the weird part. It was the Southerners who wanted the blacks counted as a whole person because it was to their advantage, their political weighting advantage. It was the Northerners who were against slavery who actually didn't want to give them any count at all. And most people seem to miss that in their reading of history. I hope Philip can look that up and never say that again.
No, I agree with you.
Okay.
The word you entered isn't in the dictionary. Electoral College in Merriam-Webster's? No, that's not true. Electoral College pronunciation. All right, I'm trying. Continental pronunciation.
Just everything. Just electoral rights, electoral this, electoral that,
electoral.
It's not electoral. It's not electoral. There's no reason to put the accent on the tor. I know I'm being very trivial here.
Occasionally I get the accent on the wrong syllable. No problem. All right, John, thank you. Appreciate it. That's
tomato, tomato.
Thanks for letting me in. Bye.
My pleasure. Well, I let you on a long time because you waited a long time. I think that's only equitable. All right, stand by. We're up on our first break already of this hour, so we're going to go ahead and do that now. And don't steal the Enterprise. And we'll be back in a little bit.
This is Herman Cain, and if it has a muzzle, a nozzle, or a blade, you'll find your topic on America Armed and Free. Sundays, right after Liberty Watch.
Swap Shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
Dawn Wells, is there anything you missed on the island?
Oh, well, actually, what I really missed, there we were with nothing to do. What I missed most was the Swap Shop. I mean, what fun we'd have had. I don't know how we'd have gotten a hold of you, but we'd have tried.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
Hi, Mark Levin here. America Armed and Free. Sounds like a good title for a book. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
Joe Smith. She's a serving lieutenant in the Navy, and she's in the intelligence branch of the Navy. And on the side, she's a world-renowned country singer.
She's got a heck of a voice.
Doesn't she? And she wrote that herself.
Wow. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So
she composes.
She's married to a retired Navy SEAL. When she come home, she's got to say, "I'm sorry, I can't talk about that to him." Yeah.
How was work today? I can't tell you.
I can't tell you. Yeah.
Was it at least good? I can't tell you.
And you know what that is about. I found that out with you when I asked you questions about nuclear stuff. Anyway, back to this. Where did we leave up? Oh, stop.
I think we never got around to what the heck was your question about the 14th Amendment?
I think we did, but it is... Well, maybe you're right, and with a growling dog behind me here. Hey, knock it off. Come over here and lay down. Lay down. Thank you.
Tyranny of the majority.
Say again? Tyranny of the majority. That's true. It's tyranny of the majority. That's a marvelous example. Telling your dog to stop barking and lay down. That's good. I love it. In what way does the 14th Amendment fly in the face of federalism insofar as it empowers the federal government to interrupt the state's abridgment of the individual's rights? I love the look on your face.
I'm still trying to understand your question.
The 14th Amendment empowers states to guarantee, for instance, the rights of the individual citizens to vote, for instance. All right?
Uh-huh.
And it empowers the federal government to interrupt the state from interrupting the rights of the individual citizen. The original Bill of Rights was never designed to do that. It only enjoined the federal government from violating people's rights. It didn't enjoin the states from doing it. What the 14th Amendment said is that the federal government has a place to stop the states from infringing on the rights of the individual citizens.
I think it's actually the second sentence, isn't it? No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States.
Right, which in effect incorporates the entire Bill of Rights on the states.
Again, here we are relitigating the darn Bill of Rights in multiple different places and ways in this country, and it's odd because we have got it stated in the Bill of Rights. It's reinforced yet again here in Article 14. And when you're saying, in what way does it abridge the right of the states?
No. No, in what way does it fly in the face of federalism to empower the federal government to keep the states from doing something to its individual citizens? That's national. That's a national form of. That's in effect nationalism, not federalism. So how do the two comport each other? Or am I still not being clear?
I feel like your question chases its tail.
Very few people in 27 years of radio have succeeded in doing that to me. Very few people.
Why don't you tell me where you're going, and then we'll figure out if we're on the right road.
Federalism says that it acknowledges the state's rights. Federalism says that the federal government will respect the rights of the state to do what they do. But the 14th Amendment says if what the states do is violative of the principles of the Constitution, the federal government may enforce against the states to enjoin them from doing that. In what way does that screw up federalism, if at all?
Federalism isn't purely a states' rights concept. Federalism is the combination of the individual's voice and the collective state's rights, and the collective of the state's rights. So the state is represented in the Senate, the collective average voice of the citizens in a particular state is supposed to be represented in the Senate. The individuals elect a representative
in the House.
In the House. And so the concept of federalism unites the voice of the individual by picking their representative and the voice of the collective state by choosing the senator. So federalism isn't about states' rights purely. It is how you marry.
It's how they interact.
Yeah, it's how you marry the voice of the individual and the collective voice of the state. That's how I see federalism.
Okay, you answered my question. This time without disempowerment. Number four. Now, I'm quoting from Federalist number 39 here. It is essential to such a government that it be derived from the great body of the society, not from an inconsiderable proportion or a favored class of it, otherwise a handful of tyrannical nobles exercising their oppressions by a delegation of their powers might aspire to the rank of Republicans and claim for their government the honorable title of Republic. It is sufficient for such a government that the persons administering it, you talked about this earlier, be appointed either directly or indirectly by the people, and that they hold their appointments by either of the tenures of just specified. Otherwise, every government in the United States, as well as every other popular government that has been or can be well organized or well executed, would be degraded from the Republican character. That answers Ingrid's point.
Yeah, actually, because I think it was Ingrid who talked about the idea that when we were formed, we were a plantocracy, right? Only men of property could vote. So you could have been a white guy and not owned real estate and you didn't have a vote. And it's very interesting because there are places where the founders contradict the structure of our government as it was created. And this is one of those places. So you start to hear that they really wanted the people to have
skin in the game.
Yeah, skin in the game. They wanted them to have the voice. And yet, as Ingrid pointed out earlier, there were defects.
Right. Well, we don't do that anymore. So what's the issue?
Well, it's fixed, and we've tried to fix some things along the way, and I think in our attempts to fix, we've broken, again, anti-17th.
I agree.
For probably the remainder of my breathing days, because I think it has taken away that state voice. I think it would make governor selections of governors phenomenally more significant if we were to abolish the 17th. Because if you considered how you want national law to be constructed, and then that would cause you to pick your governor a little bit differently, I think.
I wonder what would happen if we ran an amendment to change the 17th Amendment. I don't think you could just simply say it's repealed. I don't think there's the will in the country to do that. The question is what you'd replace it with.
I'm an originalist in that I would go back to the original structure. And you know who would make a really interesting interview for you in that question? Rod Blagojevich.
Oh, God. I went to high school with him.
He would make an interesting interview on the topic. I mean, he's the guy who was basically stuck in prison because he tried to sell a Senate seat.
I'm sure he would come on if I asked him.
And keep in mind, the 17th exists for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons was that there were a few states that actually went for a while without having senators in the U.S. Congress because the states couldn't agree. And then I think there were a couple episodes, and I think our political science caller might know off the top of his head, but there were a couple of examples where some folks tried to bullet Rod Blagojevich and sell a Senate seat. But what we've done, and the reason that I don't like the 17th, let's talk about that, is that by having the senators be popularly elected, what we've done is that now the senators are beholden to the national political party.
As opposed to the state.
As opposed to the local state. And you don't have a governor who can call up a senator and go, hey, that's not why we put you there. Stop that. If you don't stop that, I'm going to suggest that the citizens of this state impeach you. And we don't have that ability anymore.
Impeachment has become denatured, too, in a lot of ways. But in 1990, Alcee Hastings was impeached by the House and tried by the Senate, convicted and removed from the federal bench. And 2 years later, he was elected to fill a seat in the House that impeached him.
If only he'd been an insurrectionist, he couldn't have come back to life. Did we just go there?
Yeah, we did. You know, that was a riot, not an insurrection. And it was a bad idea. And
it was a guided tour.
Yeah, I know. Let me offer some advice. If you know that there's going to be a large rally with a lot of contention, don't go.
Yeah, it's kind of like with regard to carrying a firearm. People ask me, you know, do you carry everywhere? And my thing is, you don't take a gun to a place you wouldn't go without a gun.
You don't take a gun to a place you wouldn't go without a gun? Oh, you mean you don't go?
Yeah.
You don't. It's not that you wouldn't. You don't take a gun there. You just don't go. You don't go to a place that you wouldn't take a gun.
Yeah. Have you ever been to a party and thought, this thing's getting out of hand, I'm leaving?
Sure.
Same concept.
Well, that's why I don't go to New York. It's not, it's not legal to take a gun. No, it's really. The only reason I would ever go to New York was because I had some business there that couldn't be done any other place. You are facilia non grata there. That's why I don't go to Mexico. I went because my daughter got married down there, sans any weapons, and I stayed there for exactly 30 hours in Mexico, and I did not consume any product that I purchased in Mexico, and I left. I wanted to be at Cancun. I walked my daughter down the Isle of Sand to get married, and then I got on a plane and I left because I did not want to support an economy that doesn't support my rights.
Yeah.
Anyway, oh, that was a number of years ago. Five, on examining, how are we doing on time? Oop, we're up on a break. Let's do that break, and then we'll come back and do something else about the Federalist number 39. And then I will answer your calls.
The right of the people to be secure in their places from warrantless raiders. With masks on their faces means little or nothing without threat of force, without the second. What good is the fourth?
Like I say, that's the best line I ever wrote. All right. Back to the discussion with Philip Williams on Federalist number 39 on federalism versus nationalism, number 5. On examining the first relation, it appears on one hand that the Constitution is to be founded on the assent and ratification of the people of America, given by deputies elected for the special purpose, but on the other, that this assessment and ratification is given by the people, not as individuals composing one entire nation, but as composing the distinct and independent states to which they respectively belong. It is to be the assent and ratification of the several states, derived from the supreme authority in each state, the authority of the people themselves. The act, therefore, establishing the Constitution will not be national, but federal. That's exactly what we've been talking about.
Yes. As you were reading that, I was thinking about the idea, what makes Kansas different from California? There's many things, right?
The raisins.
Agriculture is huge, right, in Kansas. California, very diverse economy, also a strong agricultural center. But California has a coastline, which makes it, Port of Los Angeles is a significant place for our country. And it is a way that goods come and go for the good of the country. But Kansas doesn't have that. So at the state level and how they want their state represented in the government is important. They're both of those states are going to have different perspectives, but their views need to be represented equally. And that's where you get the Senate. That's how you get the Senate. Kansas gets two senators, and those two senators got to go have conversations with the two senators from California, and they're equal. So the concept of federalism makes each state equal, and it's a manner that allows us to take into account the different issues, requirements that each individual state would have, no matter its physical size. And that was the Electoral College. That was an innovation that allowed us to take into account those problems and the diversity and the differences of the states as they are collective units in choosing a president. And so, again, choosing a president is a federal concept. Ratifying the Constitution is a federal concept.
Right.
So the idea of federal, to boil it down, takes into account the individual's voice as well as regionally, what does a state need?
Right. By the way, most people don't know the name of the other either senator in California currently, which is number one is Adam Schiff, who's now the senior senator, and Alex Padilla, who was the junior senator in California, just as a point of reference.
Oh, I thought most people thought that California was run by Pelosi and Newsom together.
Well, Pelosi's in the House, not in the Senate. I was only talking about the Senate. Also, the last two states to ratify the United States Constitution were North Carolina and Rhode Island.
Wow, we were way off.
We were both wrong. So
I knew it was a southern state and a northern state, but I couldn't exactly.
Well, I'd said Maine, and that was way off
from
Rhode Island. And it just shows the nickname for data's creator was often wrong soon.
pen name?
Well, it was his joking name when he goofed. Overall, outside of reading the Federalist Papers, is there a particular book or reference that you like to send people to for a discussion of federalism? It's okay to say no.
Yeah, I don't actually have one, but it was really interesting, you know, when you and I talked about starting this series and looking at how what was a fast way to learn about the Federalist Papers. We'd had a conversation about, is there a book that summarizes them? And I'm not a fan of any book that would summarize the Federalist Papers. In fact, the copyright for the book that I have used to study the papers is 1952, right? That's the date, because I wanted something that I could be reasonably confident in having been published before we got into this idea of correcting definitions, and especially like over the last 10 years. I wouldn't trust a translation of the Federalist Papers that had been written the last 10 years.
I agree. I would say the last 25. The one that I have is Clinton Rossiter as the one I have. I don't know the publication date. I would imagine it's in the 60s. And it is the one I studied in college. And Gary, I can't think of Gary's last name, the professor. But it was so long ago that I smoked my pipe in class.
This is actually an Encyclopedia Britannica, great books written in 1952. That's what I've been reading. And I wanted to do, you know, the labor that is involved. Let's face it, reading these things, it's a form of English that hasn't existed in a while. They use a lot of words that, you know, sometimes I got to bust out a thesaurus in a dictionary, and I've had to read many sentences 4 and 5 times, and sometimes paragraphs 4 and 5 times, and sometimes over a couple of days, just to understand what the heck they're talking about. It's not an easy thing, but I did try to find something that might summarize the documents, but I felt like it was a better choice to actually read the original words and do the labor, look up words and ponder sentences and reread and reread and reread and make my own judgments.
Caller, your first name, please.
John.
Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, I heard you guys referring to me, and I have to apologize to Philip. Philip, I don't want to mess up your mind. Pronounce the word electoral any way you want, because the last time you screwed it up worse than before, I messed with you. And so I owe you this apology.
John, you just made me chuckle, because you instantly took me back to a day when I was crossing the border to go down to one of the maquilas, and I was with a fellow I worked with. Spanish is a romance language, right? And it's a beautiful language, especially when spoken fluently and well. And I can't claim to have mastered it, but I've got a better accent than most. And I was with my boss, and he was trying to let the Mexican officer who we were crossing the border, he was trying to help him understand where we were going. And he looked at the guy, and he says, "I'm going to El Parque de Industrial." And the federal officer just kind of, you know, he looked down, and you could tell he was not amused by the American who was attempting to pronounce the language. He let us through. And we get about a mile down the road, and I looked at my boss, and I said, "Hey, Fred, would you please stop speaking Spanish?" And he said, "Why?" I said, you're butchering it, man. You're just butchering it." So,
what is the proper pronunciation or phrase for industrial park?
Yeah. Parque de Industrial, but he just didn't have...
Oh, he didn't have the accent.
You know, not everybody has an ear for the accent, right?
Yeah, I got it.
And that's fine, but I was just like, please don't do that. Just tell them you're going to the industrial park. It's close enough that they can figure the translation.
Yeah, they can get up. Ambulance and ambulanque are enough together that you can figure it out. All right, appreciate it.
Other reason I called, I don't think Maine was a state when the Constitution was ratified.
You're absolutely right. Maine was not a colony when the Constitution was ratified. You're correct.
Right. And also, Phil keeps saying the governors appoint senators. The original notation in the Constitution says as the legislatures.
Right. But the governor came up with the appointments and the legislature approved it.
Yeah.
It was akin to how cabinets are picked, you know, but it wasn't so polite as advice and consent. It was governor made the recommendation. The legislature then voted up or down on the person who was to be sent. And there were many years where state legislatures argued so much that no senator was sent.
Yeah.
And furthermore, ending sentences with prepositions is something up with which we shall not put. Okay, John, thank you. Have a great day.
Still not done. I looked it up in the dictionary, and there every single word, election, election day, electioneer, election, elector, electoral college, electorate,
Electra, the name, Electra Complex, Electris, Electricity. Well, that's wrong.
Okay.
But anyway, it's all on the second syllable.
Fine. John, you managed to be on over a commercial. Thank you. And that'll clear the deck. Open a line.
Swap Shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track. Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
This is Caroline.
Happy chickens.
We have a 5-acre horse property for sale.
They're participating in the program.
Please make that part of the package.
A ranch with chickens. They might call that the chicken ranch.
I've been called worse.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
What do you want?
Now you get to decide how this scene ends. Or...
Stop, Earl! Stop! Stop!
Some misinformed people want to take away your daughter's choice between rape and self-defense. We're pro-choice on self-defense. Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, jpfo.org.
Shouting praise the Lord, we're on the mighty mission. All aboard, we ain't going to go in fishing. Praise the Lord and swing into position. Can't afford to be a politician. Praise the Lord, we're all between perdition and the deep blue.
And as we come towards the end of the hour, we're with Philip Williams, and he's a local entrepreneur here, a local business leader, and we have caller Mark. Mark, you're on with Philip Williams and myself, and go ahead and make your point.
Yes, I greatly appreciate what you've done here today, and it's, you know, I was not totally ignorant on the subject, but it has greatly enhanced my knowledge on this. And you were talking about what should you call the 17th topic. Might try,
right.
What'd you call it?
The push to eliminate the 17th Amendment. Go ahead.
Okay. You might try non septimus decimus.
Oh, my God.
Uh-oh.
I thought those were extinct.
And that sounds like Latin.
Yeah, it sounds more like Latin than Spanish.
Say it again. You could call it...
non septimus what?
Non septimus decimus. I was required to take a foreign language when I was a... in high school in Bavaria.
And so you took Martian?
Well, I asked, you know, can I take German? It's a foreign language. And, nein, you cannot take German. It's not a foreign language. And then I said, okay, how about English? That's a foreign language. Nein, English is not a foreign language to you. So I took something that I thought would be close to English, and I took Latin. It's not close to English, by the way.
No.
Anyway.
Non septimus decimus?
Decimus, D-E-C.
Okay, so non-17th, right?
Yeah, septimus.
Okay, it took me more than 45 seconds to figure it out. That's not a good slogan.
Well, I like to think of myself as a bright person.
Maybe you could call it XVII, Captain.
Oh. We need something simple like it's green.
Yeah.
You know the reference? When Scotty meets Picard and Scotty says, what alcohol is this? And he goes, it's green, which is what Scotty had said in the original series to the Klingons. It was an earworm to all Trekkies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Needs to be like that.
Anyway, I grew up as a Star Trek fan, little kid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Versions of the Enterprise that had the nacelles at the proper angle, proper pylon angle.
Yeah.
I'm guilty as charged. Everybody knows that Star Trek is real and Star Wars is fake.
That's it. All right, Mark, I'm letting you go. See ya. America Armed and Free, please turn your radio off and your first name, please.
Emilio.
Emilio, please go ahead. You're on the radio.
I got a deal. I got my wife was born in Mexico and I was born in Texas. So when we talk about... the House of Representatives in English. In Spanish, you can't say Casa de Representantes. You have to say Cámara. What's the deal with that?
I don't understand your question. I'm sorry, Emilio.
Okay, comment on House of Representatives. You know, they're senators, representatives.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. In Spanish, if you say Cámara de Representantes. And in English, you say House of Representatives. And I mistakenly say Casa in Spanish, and it's not Casa. Like, kind of irks me that Cámara, is that like a room in Spanish?
It must be something different in the, I think of Casa as a place where I live.
And another thing is, when you talk about House of Representatives, they call them senators, and aren't there senators are senators, and the House of Representatives are the House of Representatives, correct?
Right, but I think the difference lies in the fact that English is a great language for messing up words. I mean, there's there, and there. And,
yeah,
and fair and fair, and yeah.
And so I don't know if it's a synonym. It's not a synonym, but you have a house where you live and and then you have House of Representatives, which is a body of representatives or elected officials. So I can see how the word is actually different in Spanish. I just don't know what the correct
maybe that's why he changed it.
Yeah.
But the other ones, when they're talking about, per se, what's that be, that guy, the senator? They call him senator. He's a House of Representatives when you talk then, you know. It just kind of irks me. Why did they change that? He should say, I guess there's no word for House of Representatives. It could just say other than senator, correct?
Yeah, Mark, the Senate. The Senate and the Senate and the House, you know, if you want to get a little bit funky in the United States, you call them upper house, lower house. I don't know. Sometimes they're called chambers, the Senate chamber. I'd have to know a lot more about Spanish than I do to give you a correct answer. But I don't think, you know, Casa doesn't mean the same.
All right, Mark, you said you have the answer?
Yes, once again, Latin has come in handy, and I have to say that anyway, otherwise it would have been a waste of time. So we are a bicameral government.
Chamber.
We have two chambers.
Right.
So that is the...
Kind of like a derringer.
Latinized way of saying...
Bicameral. Chamber. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Bicameral.
Cameral. Okay.
The people's chamber and the state's chamber.
Bicameral.
Right. Except now they're both people's chambers, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's why
okay,
I'm
Mark,
anti-17.
Hang up on yourself.
All right.
Thank
okay.
you. Bye. And all right. So, last order of business. How do people get good grounding in this topic if there is any other way than reading all 84 of the Federalist Papers?
I think the correct answer is you got to read them all. You got to read them all, but you don't have to read them all. I wouldn't say sit down and like start front to back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, that's actually the way we started the series. We weren't going to read them front to back. We were trying to get a smattering of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we've actually, if you go back and listen to the series, we've done the 10th, the 14th, the 84th, 78, 70, 39, and our last one coming up here is going to be 51, which is the argument for the system of checks and balances. Right. So we've talked about faction. We talked about the office of the presidency being one person instead of three or a body. We talked about the Bill of Rights, judicial review of legislation that comes out of Congress. And now we've talked about what the heck is federalism and understanding this concept of states' rights and individual rights and how those influence the federal government. So if you were to read them in that order, 10, 14, 84, 78, 70, 39, 51, you would – at a minimum, you would have read what I would consider you would have done the least amount of reading, but developed a significantly better understanding than your average high school graduate has today coming out of their, you know, their commencement ceremony.
It's interesting. You know, I would love to do a series on the anti-federalists, which I have never really paid enough attention to. And I think it would be fun to do that. But, and when are we going to do the last one? What date is it going to be?
51. We've been doing the first Sunday, right?
Yeah, we've been doing the first Sunday. Well, this is the second Sunday, isn't it?
That one might be tight for me because that's going to be February 2nd.
Yeah, so let's do the 9th?
Yeah, let's do the 9th.
Okay, I don't have anything booked then. You'll be
so
on
the 9th will be 51, so that is the argument for the system of checks and balances.
Okay, I'll put that in my phone as soon as we get off the air. I don't want to try and do that and this at the same time. Closing remarks, 50 seconds.
I love the conversation we had today.
You know, me too.
Four sheets of paper. It's about as long as the Constitution itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation is where understanding comes from, right? And I love that we had folks that don't see it the way we see it.
I especially appreciate folks who don't see it the way we see it, because it causes us to shift our perspective, if not to see it from their point of view, then at least how to provide a counterbalance to that point of view.
Right. Yeah, because this is a significant discussion going on in the country right now, that the Electoral College is a dinosaur. But it's only a dinosaur. If everybody understood it, then I would feel more confident in the logic. But I'm still in a place where I think we need to be talking about it, making sure. Don't change something until you understand why it is the way it is.
I agree with you. You know, it should not be changed, as it's, I've heard it said, for light and transient causes.
Yeah.
You talked us right up to the theme music. I appreciate it. That was a wonderful 2 hours.
Spirited conversation.
Yep. I want to encourage everyone to be vigorous, not violent, vigilant, not vituperative, in liberty and in thought, hopefully generating some deep thought in others. I'm Charles Heller.
The grace and truth lead us on to victory. The grace and truth lead us on to victory.
AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson.